The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome our introducer, Morris Williams.
Delighted to add my word of welcome to Andy's and also to the overflow crowd upstairs, because we're sold out both downstairs and in the overflow area upstairs. And so if anybody is interested in buying the library a new auditorium, see Susan Gould after the talk. I think among many adjectives that I think we can use to describe Misty Copeland, three come to my mind: talented, determined, and able to overcome adversity. Among her many famous roles that she has performed on stage are The Firebird, Clara in Nutcracker, and Odette in Swan Lake. She will be interviewed tonight by Tracy Matizak, Philadelphia's own wonderful interviewer. I urge you to buy both books, because this is her new book about diet and dance, but this is a story life in motion of her life, where you really get the highlights of the adversity that she's overcome, the talent and determination that is so evident in her life today. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in giving a wonderful Philadelphia welcome to Misty Copeland.
Okay, so here's the plan for this evening. Misty and I will chat for about 25, 30 minutes, and then we're going to open the floor for your questions. We'll have some people with microphones who will come to you so that we can hear your questions. So while we're chatting, if something comes to mind, make sure to make a note of it, and we'll try to get in as many questions as we can before we wrap for the evening. So with that said, Misty, first, let me congratulate you on your wedding. You are a newlywed.
I did not think I didn't think you were going to congratulate me on that.
Well, there are lots of things to congratulate you for, but certainly that's one of them. How are you juggling marriage and ballet these days?
It's easy, actually. I've been with my husband now for over a decade, so it doesn't feel that different. Yeah. So he understands that ballet was my first boyfriend, so...
So he respects that.
He respects it.
Well, we want to talk about your beautiful new book, Ballerina Body. You all, chances are, have seen it, have a copy of it with you. This is not your first book. Your first one was more autobiographical in nature. This one is more of a lifestyle book with a lot of exercise and nutrition tips and that sort of thing. Why did you decide to share your secrets, so to speak?
There's something so beautiful about the classical ballet world, about the classical ballet technique and the history and the tradition of it. And we learn from each other. I feel like I've become just this organic mentor because of what I've learned from classical dance. We wouldn't know the choreography if we didn't have a former dancer who had learned it from the original choreographer at some point. It's passed down knowledge, and so I feel like that's just so much a part of me. And so why have these experiences and discover yourself and learn all of these things if you're not going to share it and pass it down? So that's a part of, I think, what I'm doing with the book. But there's so many reasons. I feel like people, especially in America, deserve to understand what it is and what it takes to create a dancer, a professional athlete, a ballerina, a ballet dancer. There's so many parts to us, and it's a very difficult and long journey to get to the place of being a professional dancer. And I wanted to get rid of a lot of the stereotypes that I think people have. When you think of a classical dancer, you think of someone very thin, possibly has an eating disorder. that's not very physically strong, and they just kind of go on stage and look beautiful and twirl around. And I wanted to give people a real idea of all that it takes to create a dancer. And it's you know, taking care of your body and your emotional and mental health and being focused and prepared, and what you're eating is so much more a part of it than just being physically active and having the right support as well.
I think many people, Misty, did not understand until you came along the sheer athleticism that is involved in ballet.
Good.
It's about time.
It's about time.
One of the themes of the book, it seems to me, is that you really want the reader to be comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
Right? This is not about striving to achieve the impossible, but being comfortable with who mm-hmm. you are.
I think that's the first step, and something that it took me a long time to learn and to accept, you know, starting at the age of 13, starting really late in terms of classical training, being the only African-American woman in American Ballet Theater for over a decade, all of these things, you know, being a woman and experiencing having your body change. And when you're in a field like this and your body is your instrument and that's what everyone's looking at when you're on stage, and not feeling comfortable and confident in my own skin, it really took a toll on me. And I feel like I learned so much about accepting who I am right now in order to be better. And I think that's something that we don't accept as people, that, you know, we do these dieting, we do these diets and we have these goals set, like, oh, when I reach this weight, I'll be happy and then I can continue on with my life, or when I fit into this dress or fit into these pants. And I feel like if you, like, when you reach that point, it doesn't mean you're going to be happy. And it's about enjoying the process and the journey. And as a dancer, that's our life. It's not just about being on the stage and saying, oh, I'm going to be happy and enjoy it when I get on stage. But we put so much into the training and being into the studio, you know, six days a week sometimes, 8 hours a day. And so you have to enjoy the process and the journey.
It would be hard to imagine, looking at you, that you would have struggles with body image when you were younger. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what that was like for you?
I mean, I think every woman especially experiences this, you know, with our bodies changing and going through puberty. And it's really difficult to do that as a professional athlete with all eyes on you. You know, so it was during a very difficult time. I was already a professional in the company when my body changed. And I didn't understand how to take care of my body. I didn't grow up in a household that nurtured an athlete or an artist. My mother didn't cook, and so I was, you know, we were struggling financially, so a lot of the time I was eating whatever was being given to me just to survive, you know, canned vegetables and hot dogs and cup of noodle, and, you know, they weren't things that you should be eating when you're an athlete. So, you know, when I became an adult and I moved to New York City at 17 years old, there was no one there to show me the way, and it's just like, figure it out on your own. And I gained a lot of weight, and as an artistic director, you know, they're not there to be your parent, so I was told to lose weight, and that's a really difficult thing to experience at such a young age when you have no guidance, no support, and don't really know what to do. So it took having amazing mentors that came into my life that really have helped me and supported me and helped me to accept the body that I have and I had, and to know that it's okay not to look like the person next to you, to be an individual and just be your healthiest self.
I know you're asked this a lot, but I want you to tell the Krispy Kreme story, because I think so many of us can relate to that story on so many levels.
Yeah, it was during that really difficult time, and I think that a lot of people, maybe if they were being told to lose weight, would experience, you know, maybe starving themselves or going that route to, you know, satisfy the person who asked. And I went the opposite route. I started overeating just to emotionally feed myself. And it was a really, really difficult time. And again, as a young adult, I had no idea how to approach this in a mature way. And so I would go home at night and I would call Krispy Kreme, and they told me they could only deliver to corporations. So I called them back and I told them I was a corporation. And I would get 2 dozen Krispy Kreme donuts delivered, and I would eat 1 dozen in one sitting. And it was emotional eating, and it was how I was dealing in that moment. And then I would feel horrible afterwards, and I'd go into the studio and have to look at myself in the mirror, and it was just this horrible cycle. I think that it was really understanding that I only have one body, and my body is my instrument. It's how I do what I do. It's how I make my living. It's my craft. It's my art. And I think when I really put those two things together, it made more sense for me. Like, you hold this responsibility if this is what you want to do.
But I think we can relate to that, because at some point all of us have overdone it on Krispy Kremes or whatever our equivalent of that is. And so it's good to know that we're not alone. Misty, one of, I think, the key themes that I've heard you talk about is opening up the world of ballet to a more diverse audience. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important to you, and what are you doing in that regard to open up that world?
Yeah, you know, it's just so interesting. If a child isn't exposed to seeing something, there's no way they can dream and have an imagination and think that that's possible for them. And if you don't see yourself represented in certain spaces, then it doesn't seem tangible in any way. I don't think I realized at 13 years old, I feel like I was in this little bubble in San Pedro, California, and I was, brought into the ballet world at 13 years old and told I was a prodigy and just kind of coddled. And 4 years later, I was thrust into New York City and I was in a professional company. And I think that's when it hit me that it's rare to be an African American. It's rare to be a minority in the classical ballet world. And I felt so alone, and I'd never experienced that in my life. And then meeting other dancers of color, especially black dancers, and it was like we all had the exact same story, and meeting older women who were like, I wish that I would have had someone like you. I would have been on a different path. I maybe would have been a professional or would have pushed harder against people telling me you don't belong, you don't fit in, this isn't for you, you should try hip-hop or modern or jazz. And so I understand the importance for the classical ballet world to grow, but also just to give hope to the next generation.
And you were told, you're too old, you're too brown, too big, all of those things along the way.
Yes. Yeah. And all of it just really takes a toll on you. And there were times when I thought about quitting. I thought about leaving ABT and going somewhere where it would be easier for me, where I would fit in and I would be more accepted. And it's very interesting because Dance Theatre of Harlem clearly was that company where being an African-American dancer, you could go and thrive and you're surrounded by people who look like you. And I was invited to take company class with them when I was still pretty new in American Ballet Theater. And Arthur Mitchell ended up offering me a soloist contract. And he said to me, you're worth so much. And know that every day walk into American Ballet Theater, that it's not about the color of your skin. Like, walk in there and know that you are special. And no one can take that away from you. And he said, so are you going to take the contract? And it was in that moment, I think, that I realized that was an easy way out. And that ABT was my goal and my dream, and I was going to fight and push for change, even if it didn't happen for me to be promoted, but for someone in the future.
So you took the road less traveled, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
It must be a joy to you to see young ballerinas of color beginning to come up through the ranks, young children, a more diverse group than perhaps there was when you were getting started.
It's incredible. It's been amazing, it's not just me. It could have been any black woman in this position. But once they see themselves represented, once we see ourselves represented on the stage, it opens up the floodgates. Seeing the diversity in the audience the first time I performed Firebird in New York City at the Metropolitan Opera House was unbelievable. And I remember people backstage asking me if that was my family in the audience. I said, I don't have that much family. But it's sparked so much change and hope. You know, I think that even parents feel more comfortable stepping into the Metropolitan Opera House. It's like, okay, now I feel like we are accepted here, we belong here. And that's a huge thing for our communities to feel that way. And it's been great that ABT's been kind of right there with me, and I've been able to help to start a diversity initiative that we have called Project Plie. That's really sparking a lot of change. Mm.
And you mentioned Firebird, which is also the title of your children's book.
Yeah. The book is not about the story, Firebird. That would have been a little crazy for the kids, I think. it's actually based loosely around the relationship I have with a former ballerina, Raven Wilkinson, who was also such a strong supporter and someone before I even met her that just gave me that extra push when I was feeling like, what am I doing here? She was a former ballerina with the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. She was the first black woman to dance in the company. Her career was cut pretty short because of the racism in the South when the company was touring, and the KKK knew she was a part of the company and they were looking for her. So she ended up leaving the company, but she lives around the block from me, and she's in her 80s now, and she's so incredible. And so the book Firebird is based around our relationship, like a young dancer that's struggling and trying to kind of find her way, and then an older, more accomplished dancer that's guiding her.
You and President Obama sat down to do an interview together. You were both among the 100 top influencers for Time Magazine in 2015. And in that interview, you shared with him that there was something that you encountered having become a principal dancer that you had not prepared for mentally and emotionally. And I want to read this to make sure that I get it right. But you said, the one thing you had not prepared for was what to do when you got to the top, or as you put it, how to stay grounded and humble and striving mm-hmm. at that level. How do you answer that question? How do you stay humble and grounded and striving? Right.
I don't feel like I have a problem with that. I was curious to know how he deals with that. I mean, that's a very different position from being a principal dancer, being the president of the United States. I felt like we had some commonality there, you know, stepping into a position of being the first. But for me, I don't feel like that's something that I struggle with. It's been very important for me always to go back and reach back and bring people with me. Like, that's why I'm here. I feel like I'm not just here to be a dancer. It's an incredible opportunity and an incredible journey and career. But I feel like I represent so much more, and it's not just about me. So I feel like it's very easy for me to stay grounded and humble.
And the striving part, Misty, even
the
now,
striving is interesting and different.
Yeah, as a principal dancer, I mean, that never ends, right?
Right. I'm it's still so new. I'm still doing new roles right now. I just performed Giselle for the first time like 3 days ago. So I have a lot of things that are still very new. I don't think that, you know, I've never been one to get bored with a role. Like, it's always been very interesting for me to find new things to work on. But it's just, you know, and it's weird to think of things in this way, but right after I was promoted, it felt like this is kind of the last chapter in my career. It was like the beginning of the end, and I was like, oh, this is kind of sad when I should be so happy.
Do you think about retirement at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I'm 34 now, so that's definitely in the near future. It is. I mean, as a dancer, that's older.
Have you thought about what you might want to do after ballet?
No. I mean, I have so many incredible opportunities and so many things I'm a part of that I never, ever dreamed would be happening. So I feel like I'm just keeping things open, and I know I will continue to write. I think that's something that I will always do. I will be connected to ballet. I will continue to push for diversity and continue to have that conversation and just keep it alive.
We did have one person suggest that she should run for president, so there is a whole other career out there if you're interested. Misty, you've had a number of opportunities to work with Prince in the past. You toured with him in Europe, and of course we lost him just about this time last year. Yeah. Can you talk about your experiences in working with him and how you remember him now?
Gosh, I remember him silly, goofy, quiet, just incredible. The first time that I worked with him, I was pretty young and knew a new soloist in the company. And when he reached out to me, I was so confused. I was like, how does he know who I am? How did he get in contact with me? And I filmed a music video with him, and then he disappeared, and I hadn't heard from him for a really long time. And I was like, okay, that was interesting. But he invited me then to tour with him, I think almost a year later, maybe. And I traveled through France with him, and that was the first opportunity. You know, growing up, I knew who he was. I had heard his music, but I didn't know that much about him. Also, my mom was kind of like, you're not listening, you're not watching Prince. That's a little too mature.
You were more of a Mariah Carey fan, right?
Yes, I was. but the first time that I was on stage with him, it was just eye-opening, and it sparked something in me as an artist that I didn't know was there. And I think that he's just was such an individual that he made me feel like it's okay to be different and to try things and figure yourself out, figure out what's inside of you and what you have to offer. And I feel like that was kind of the beginning of me really growing into becoming an artist. And we ended up working together for over the course of 5 years, I think. So it was a big loss.
Yeah. I think so many of us felt that loss, but certainly all the more for someone like you who worked closely with him.
Yeah. It was very, very difficult. But I feel like he is still with me. And he was such a big supporter. He came and saw me at ABT a lot. He'd even sneak into these tiny little shows I was doing, like community shows, like with Black ballet schools, where I'd come in and just do like a guest appearance at the Apollo. And he'd sneak in, and it was literally like a recital. I was like, you don't have to come to this. He's like, I'm coming. So he was very supportive. Yeah.
One of the many barriers that you have broken along the way, Misty, is in the world of advertising. You've had a number of endorsements, probably most notably Under Armour. Yeah. You did an ad that went viral for them. Why was it important to you to do that ad?
Well, to me, it made perfect sense. Like ballerinas, dancers, we should be getting endorsement deals. We're athletes. We're beyond athletes. Like, it's crazy to me in America that we don't have that same respect. We're not given the same opportunities. We're not paid the same money. And so my brilliant manager, Gilda, kind of made that all happen and was like, you know, got Under Armour on board. And I think it was a big leap of faith for them in the beginning. But I've always felt like if people are given an opportunity to see the behind the scenes, to see the training and the athleticism, our muscles, like to not have me in a tutu, to really see my body and see what it takes, that people are going to be interested. And the craziest thing to me is to see like American men who have like, they're like, oh, I want to come to the ballet now. And I'm like, this is good.
That's a change. About your regimen, Misty. I know you talked about, 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, I think you said at one point. Tell us about what a week, I don't know if there's such a thing as a typical week, but what is your regimen like?
Yeah, it's different all the time, which I think keeps it exciting and fun. On a normal, like a rehearsal period for ABT, we're in New York City where we're based, and we work Tuesday through Saturday, so we'll start at 10:15. Every single morning we take ballet class, and cause everyone always asks me, you're still taking ballet class? Like, you're 34. I'm like, yes. It's what we do every day, not just to warm up our bodies for the rehearsal day or for the performance, but to keep our instrument fine-tuned, to keep our technique up, to keep our strength up. So we start with a ballet class that goes from 10:15 to 11:45, and then our rehearsal day starts at 12, and we go till 7, most likely, sometimes with an hour lunch break in between, but sometimes not. And then when we are in performance season, it's pretty much the same. We'll start at around 10, and we'll work until maybe 5 or 5:30, and then we'll have a show in the evening around 7:30. And so we're about to go into our spring season, so that's 2 months straight of 6 days a week of performing and rehearsing during the day when we're not performing. But if I'm in an off week from ABT, I'm doing book tours and shoots and interviews and things like that. Yeah. But there's always ballet class in the morning before it all.
So when do you eat? I'm thinking with all those hours of rehearsal, I'm trying to figure out when you have time to eat.
I mean, I don't know how other ballet companies work, but American Ballet Theatre, things are always really tight, so it's important to have food with you at all times. Or you use the phone that's in the studio, and you call and you order food, and it's brought to the studio, and you eat it on your five-minute break. But that's a big part of the book, too, for me, is the importance of having like protein with me all the time and healthy fats and things that are going to keep my energy up throughout the day, and nuts are something that... like I'll open up an old dance bag and I'm like, oh, there are nuts in there that are probably so old. But they're always with me, just things, bananas, things that are gonna, you know, that are easy to digest. I don't like to eat big heavy meals during the day just because I'm physically active. It's when I get home that I cook and I make a big dinner.
You like to cook?
I love to cook.
Yeah.
I should have said that when you said, what are you gonna do after? I'm gonna cook a lot.
Yeah. What do you like to cook?
Everything. Let's see. Last night, I was on the road doing another event, but I had like 20 minutes here at home, and so I'd start cooking, and then I'd leave, and then I'd come back, and I'd cook a little more and set it aside so I could eat it when I got home. I baked artichokes, and I made my own clarified butter, and then I made this Asian tofu stir fry.
So you like to cook.
I love to cook. Yes.
And really, I think one of the things I picked up from your book was that it's really about thinking about food as fuel, mm-hmm. right? I mean, making that change in mindset to just, you know, food for food's sake,
right.
Food as fuel.
Yes. Yeah. I think especially as an athlete, it's important to think that way. But I think also that you can enjoy food that's good for you. And that's been such a struggle to express that to people, that, you know, it's so hard to let go of things that you're emotionally tied to. Like, it's all of us have that with food. You have memories. It's comforting. You get into a cycle. And the more you eat something, the more you crave it. So it's really hard to break that cycle. But healthy food can taste good. You know, it doesn't have to be fried foods. It doesn't have to be soaked in butter. It doesn't have to come from a can. It doesn't have to come from a fast food restaurant. And just because it's healthy food also, it doesn't mean that it's going to cost you an arm and a leg.
Yeah.
I think it's possible to find healthy food that's affordable and just learning how to make it.
And there are a lot of great recipes in the book as well that you'll have to try. I want to talk a little bit about some of your roles, and this might be asking, you know, who's your favorite relative, or asking a parent who their favorite child is, but do you have a favorite role to date?
It changes all the time. Juliet for a while was it for me, and I think that's when I realized, actually the first time I realized this, and I'm sorry to call you out, Angel Correa, sitting here in the front row, who was like my, like one of my biggest idols growing up. I don't know if you know this, you were the first live like ballet I ever saw. I saw you perform with Paloma Herrera in California doing Don Quixote. I was 15 and I'd never been to a ballet. But my point is to say, I performed a ballet called Sinatra Suite, which is a Twyla Tharp work, and I performed it with On Health for the first time. We were in London, I believe. And that was the first time I realized that I enjoy acting on stage, that I'm good at it. And I think that that has drawn me to Giselle and to Juliet. But I think that's a strength of mine that I didn't realize before. I think also getting older, you know, I used to be able to just kind of like muscle through things, and I was very physical. And the older I get, I'm like, I can't just push like that. And it's about finding the details and the refinement. And I feel like I can't go on stage and truly be invested in, and present without like a character that I can really like dive into. So Juliet, but Giselle right now. Yeah.
Roles that you aspire to?
Well, I'm going to be doing Khichri this season for the first time, so that's a big one for me. And I always thought this was, I mean, I did it, like, not at this level, but when I was really young, it was, again, the first ballet I saw live, and I was like, oh, Khichri was everything to me. And now I feel like maybe I'm not really Khichri. I don't know. She's very sassy and fiery and strong, and I feel like I've gotten so used to now playing these characters that Black women have always been told they're not. And so it's very interesting. I feel more connected to those roles now.
You mentioned muscling through certain roles, and you certainly had to do that with Firebird. Mm-hmm. You had major injuries when you danced that role. Tell us about that, how you power through that, and how you're managing injuries even now.
Yeah. It's something that every dancer experiences, and especially at a professional level. It's, again, you know, comparing us to athletes, it's the same. When I was preparing for the role of Firebird, I was also preparing for a couple of other second leading roles that had a lot of jumping in it. And it was a big deal at 29 years old to be given that opportunity for the first time. That's very late in a ballerina's career as a soloist to be given, you know, a principal role of that stature. So I was just pushing and pushing so hard. And I just kind of like pushed aside the pain I was feeling in my leg, which was severe, severe pain, nothing I'd ever experienced. So once I got through that first performance in New York City, I found out I had 6 stress fractures in my tibia, and 3 of them were almost full breaks. So I went to a doctor who works with Knicks players and does a lot of operations for professional athletes. And he said to me, like, oh, I see this with football players all the time. And I was like, oh, this makes me feel so good. Like, I want to... But like that people need to understand that like we have just as much like impact on our bodies as a football player, as a basketball player, you know, from jumping. So I ended up having a plate screwed into my tibia, and it's now been 5 years since the surgery, but I still have issues with it, and it's about managing and you know, so much of the motion part, the movement part of the book. I learned when I was recovering from this surgery, I discovered it's not the typical floor bar technique. It's very unique. It's a French guy named Boris Kanisev, and his technique was passed down to a woman that lives around the corner from me also, kind of. And she worked with me, and it kind of helped me to just reassess my technique, you know, at almost 30 years old. It was like relearning how to dance. And so a lot of that is what I put in the book, because it's something that anyone can do. It's not just for dancers. It's for people that have never even been physically active. And I think that when you're using gravity and you're laying on the floor, it's easier for you to work correctly and to allow your alignment, the gravity to align you in a proper way.
So really, you can be a beginner at this, you can be any age.
I'm encouraging everyone to try it, yeah. Men included, and you don't have to put tights on.
See, that might be the thing that makes them try it.
I know.
Is it true that you go through something like 10 pairs of pointe shoes a week?
Yes. Yeah. It's normal when you're a professional. We're allotted 10 pairs of pointe shoes at ABT. And especially during a performance season, I definitely go through that many. But I wear a new pair of pointe shoes every single day in class. And we'll keep different pointe shoes around depending on the strength you need for certain roles, or if you need a softer shoe, depending on if you're doing a jumping role or something that you need more support. We go through a lot of pointe shoes. When you're dancing 8 hours a day and sweating through, you know, these shoes, you need the support.
Well, before we turn it over to our audience for their questions, Misty, I'm sure we have some young dancers with us tonight. What would you say to aspiring ballerinas who might be listening tonight?
If I could go back and talk to my younger self, I would just say, not to compare yourself to other people, not to get caught up in other people's opinions. I feel like that kind of overwhelmed me for so long, and it's okay and beautiful to be unique and to be an individual. Listen to your parents. Listen. I think, you know, just it's so important to have that guidance and that support and that love around you always, even when you're an adult and a professional.
Yeah. Well, on that note, why don't we open it up for your questions? Thank you, Misty. So if you have a question for Misty, just raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you, and we'll get in as many questions as we're able.
Do you get nervous backstage?
Sometimes. It really depends on the situation and the atmosphere in the ballet. Like, before I did my first Giselle, I was so calm. It was like, oh, I'm excited to do this. But I think, yeah, it depends on the ballet, but I do sometimes. And that's when I feel like I just take really deep breaths before I go on stage. And again, like once I step out there, like I am the character. And that really helps me to not be outside of myself and judging myself and think other people are there to judge me, that I'm just in the moment and present, and it really helps with nerves.
Okay.
Does moving away from your family affect like the way you dance?
I was so excited to become a professional that I couldn't wait to leave home. I think I grew a lot once I was outside of my community and my ballet school, and I was exposed to other dancers that came from all over the country, all over the world, and it made me grow like in leaps and bounds.
Misty, you talked in your book about the importance of the Boys and Girls Clubs. Could you talk a little bit about your views on after-school programs and what role they should play in the lives of young people today?
Yes, thank you. It's so extremely important. Growing up in a single-parent home and not always having a stable place to live or a place to live at all, the Boys and Girls Club was like a home for me. And so we were there every single day after school, and it was just a safe place for us to be. And then on top of it, we were, you know, tutored, and then I was then plucked into, you know, and told, oh, go take this ballet class that's happening right now in the basketball court. And I was like, okay. And that's where it all got started, at my Boys and Girls Club.
All right, we've got lots of questions.
When do you sleep?
Now that's a good question.
Sleep, and I say this in the book as well, it's so much a part of a dancer's life. There's no shortcuts. There's no, like, creating fake energy. You have sleep, and that's so important for me. Like, my nickname is Grandma with a lot of...
A good giggle out of that.
Because, especially with the schedule I have nowadays, I just really hang out. And so, you know, all my friends are like, yeah, let's go to dinner, and it's late after a show. And I'm like, I gotta go to bed. And they're like, okay, Grandma, bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.